So be sure to tune in next Wednesday for more news from the Boo.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sex Workers film series, which on Saturday, July 5th at 7 p.m. will show The Price of Sex. This feature-length documentary sheds light on the underground criminal network of human trafficking and the experiences of trafficked Eastern European women forced into prostitution abroad. The Price of Sex includes first-person accounts, as well as interviews with traffickers, clients, and anti-trafficking activists to expose the root causes, complex connections, and stark significance of sexual slavery today. Again, that's Saturday, July 5th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for an IT contractor to work with our organization 15 hours a week at $25 an hour, providing on-site IT support as well as website maintenance support. Essential qualifications include at least 5 years of general IT network and server maintenance and website administration, experience with PHP, MySQL, experience in Drupal 6 and 7, ability to maintain rack-mounted server and maintain a local area network of Windows XP, 7, and 8 workstations. Send a resume and cover letter addressing the above qualifications and the question, why KBOO is important, to hiring@kboo.org or drop it off for IT hiring team at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. More information can be found at kboo.fm/hiring.
Santa Muerte, or Saint Death, is pictured as a female skeleton in robes. Her shrines are found in Mexican prison cells and drug houses. She presides over the shadowy battleground of the war between the Gulf Cartel and Los Zetas. Hi, this is Per Fogring, host of Fight the Empire. Thursday, I'll be speaking with Michael Diebert, author of In the Shadow of Saint Death. That's Thursday, July 3rd at 9:30 a.m. In the Shadow of Saint Death on KBOO, your radio station.
Stored broadcasts exclusively found here in our archives. We will present the best of these recordings, primarily the voices from those involved in the voter registration movement in the Mississippi Delta region in the early 1960s.
You're listening to From the Archives. We're going to go to Pacifica from the Vault and a celebration of Civil Rights 50th anniversary.
Present the best of these recordings, primarily the voices from those involved in the voter registration movement in the Mississippi Delta region in the early 1960s. In one particular documentary, simply called The Mississippi Delta from January 1964, you will get a rare glimpse at the incredible effort and sacrifices made to register African Americans to vote in a region where they had been historically disenfranchised.
If you don't say right quick that you will stop these demonstrations, I'm gonna hit you with this hammer. And he began to rant, you know, and say, well, I gotta stop you, I gotta stop you. I said, why? He said, if I don't stop you from marching in the streets, it won't mean anything for me to be white anymore.
You will also hear from voices that tried their best to prevent this from happening. Let's begin with the voice of famed Pacifica producer Dale Miner, who introduced this program.
Pacifica Radio presents next the Mississippi Delta.
You and I, and others throughout the nation, have been witnessing communist front organizations recently. Demonstrators, sit-in strikers, hoodlums and left-wingers, freedom riders and such groups as that. But thank God, most of them get in jail when they come to Jackson. And I'll tell you, I have arranged at Parchman, Mississippi, for 300 places for the next hoodlum to come to Mississippi.
None your man done gone. None your man done gone. None your man done gone to the county farm. None your man.
The state of Mississippi was as good as its governor's word through the summer of 1963. Demonstrators, sit-in strikers, freedom riders, and such groups as that were repeatedly and in large quantities accommodated in the city jails, county farms, and the state penitentiary at Parchment.
Mississippi Freedom Project, 1964. This is a recorded report on the volunteer effort to register voters and set up community centers in Mississippi. This program, part of a series prepared by the Student Coordinating Committee of Los Angeles, presents the remarks of a field secretary of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee telling about his first interests in the Southern student movement, and it includes a report on the recent freedom vote held in Mississippi.
My name is Matthew Jones. I'm from Knoxville, Tennessee, and I've worked with SNCC in all areas of the South. And to begin this talk, I guess I should start with what happened in 1960 when I was a student at Tennessee State University in Nashville. There was a movement just beginning to start. It was around February. It was in the latter part of February. And there were some students that started to go down to restaurants in the area, sitting in. And most of the students at ANI, they say, you know, this must be some kind of hogwash. You know, what is this new idea, this Gandhi? You know, everybody wanted to know what it was. And we weren't really interested one way or another. We knew that we needed to be able to eat in these restaurants. But we were really afraid. You know, it was brand new. And I read the paper the next day, and I saw this white fella laying out with his head bloody under some stools at this Woolworth counter. And I became so embarrassed, you know. This white fella doing, you know, my job for me. And I decided right there, you know, that I had to do something. And I'll never forget, I went to this assembly where the president of the university was talking. And he told us that the governor of Tennessee would give us two $30,000 buses if we wouldn't demonstrate, if we wouldn't go uptown and try to sit in and get a hamburger. And, well, I became frustrated at that moment, and I just walked out, and I walked a mile up the road, you know, where these people were, these sit-inners, you know, this new thing was going on. And I walked in, and they gave me some lessons in nonviolence. And they said, look, say, we don't want anybody to go but people who have gone before. But I wanted to go so bad. You know, I wanted to join the struggle so bad that I told them, you know, that I had been arrested before. And I went uptown to this restaurant. It's called Kane Sloan's. And we walked in, and we were supposed to go in and sit down. But when we got there, this big chain was across the door. And, well, we decided, you know, we mapped out our strategy. We said, well, we'll stand in front of this chain, you know. And if anyone would come up, we would tell them that we were there first and we'd like to be served. And, well, the manager came up and he said, well, you boys will have to move away because my customers have to come in. You know, we told them we were customers because we had just bought something at the other counters. And they still wouldn't let us in. And, you know, and we stood at this chain, and I'll never forget, there was a big mirror in front of me. And we saw the white people beginning to come in. It was about 250 in this basement. And this big white fella, around 260 pounds, came rushing toward my back, you know, and I was looking in the mirror, you know, and I just braced myself, you know, and I just looked in the mirror. And he ran up and he stopped right behind me and he shook his head, you know, and he walked away. I was really frightened because I was ready, you know, to go through this mirror. And they took us to jail. It was my first time in jail. It was a very depressing thing, you know. Very few people had been to jail for civil rights, you know, at that time. And we really didn't know what it was all about. So from then, I began to work in the Nashville student movement. And I just so happened, I graduated from school, from college that year. And the president had told us, said, look, sir, if you demonstrate, Matthew, you know, he took us into this this little conference, so you won't be able to graduate. And I told him, graduate into what? You know, I wanted to know what. To be Uncle Tom like he was. You know, I was really upset, you know, because I began to see what was really going on. Well, at the end of that year, you know, I, like everybody else, we wonder whether we should really go into things like this. We had been taught so long that education was the solution. And I decided, I said, look, should I go wholeheartedly into the movement or should I teach school for a while? Well, I taught school, and not knowing that this is freedom, you know, that I would not be able to sit back anymore. I lost two jobs, you know, and I decided then that if I really wanted to educate kids, that I would have to change the system. And I dropped teaching, and I went to graduate school in Knoxville, Tennessee, where I became real involved. Marion Barry, ex-chairman of SNCC, was also going to school, you know, at the same place. So I decided there that I would join the movement full-time. And this was in the summer of 1963. I had already been arrested about 15 times.
Mississippi Freedom Project, 1964. This is a recorded report on the volunteer effort to register voters and set up community centers in Mississippi.
My name is Matthew Jones. I'm from Knoxville, Tennessee, and I'm a field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Now, in talking about personal experiences and in terms of nonviolence, I would like to relate to you an experience that I had in Danville, Virginia. I was placed in jail there in a very small cell with no running water, and they had me on a fast for, I shouldn't say fast, really, they just wouldn't feed me, you know. I shouldn't use terms of fast and what jailers do. It's a very large demonstration. Martin Luther King had come into town, and there was this a long line of about 200 people. But really, you know, only 13 went to jail, basically because a week or so before then, 49 people had been beaten pretty near to death, and had been 200-pound pressure fire hoses had been turned on them, and people were really afraid. So 13 of us went on this demonstration. It was 11 o'clock at night, and they threw us in jail, and then they took us to the city farm in Danville, Virginia, and I was laying there in this tight cell. They call it tight cell. It's very small, and it has no running water or anything like that. And they wouldn't feed me. They gave me a third of a biscuit and a cup of water, you know, every meal. And well, after 10 days, They gave me a physical examination to see if I could stand work in the rock hole. You know, it's these old rock holes where you knock big rocks into little rocks. And they took me out there, and I was bursting rocks with this 20-pound sledgehammer, and all of a sudden, two white fellows came, and they stood around me, and they said, "Look, you're one of those demonstrators, aren't you?" You know, and I said, "Yes." And they said, "If you don't say that, if you don't say right quick that you will stop these demonstrations, I'm gonna hit you with this hammer." So I looked at him, and miraculously, I don't know, he dropped his hammer and he began to hit me with his fist, and he knocked me into some rocks. And the prison administration got me and took me into this cell. And when I got into this cell, he was put into the cell next to me. And I told him that I had forgiven him for what he had done. And he began to rant, you know, and say, "Well, I got to stop you. I got to stop you." I said, "Why?" He said, "If I don't stop you from marching in the streets, it won't mean anything for me to be white anymore." And this really struck me. This really struck me deep down within. And while I was there, when the policeman saw that I was in pretty good physical condition, it frightened them. I guess they thought some God was with me or something. And at that time, I'd grown a beard, and they began to come in at night and say that I wish I could let you out, but I can't. You know, I wish I could feed you, you know, but they won't let me feed you. And then then the prison administrator came in and said, "Matthew," he said, "you know, it's not but one difference between you and Jesus Christ." And I said, "What is that?" You know, he said, "He's on heaven and you're on earth." You know, well, it struck me, because he's a very religious man. They said they ought to teach you, you know, Bible lessons in Sunday school every morning. But that really bothered me. I could see this jailer change from one position, from a position where he had just beaten Negro demonstrators with chains, you know, a week or so before, you know, into a person that you could really talk to him. And we became fast friends, you know. And he gave me his address and told me to write him, you know. And he told us how, said, "Well, look, I know you're going to win, but I got to put these stumbling blocks in front of you, you know. I just have to do that. You know, it looks good." You know, this kind of thing. And I could see how he was just a slave to the system himself.
A special report from the Council of Federated Organizations, Jackson, Mississippi. Despite Bunting's reading "Peace on Earth, Goodwill Toward Men," the Christmas holidays in Mississippi were marred by bombings, beatings, and harassments. Mingled with Christmas carols was the cry for funds for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, who are launching their drive to challenge the seating of the five Mississippi representatives in Congress come January the 4th. Voter registration drives continued, and the freedom schools operated by the Council of Federated Organizations functioned as usual. Throughout the state of Mississippi, Freedom Democratic Party members are holding fundraising activities to supply transportation to Washington, D.C. to challenge the seating in Congress of the five Mississippi representatives. The Freedom Democratic Party feel they have a constitutional right for the challenge.
Bombings and threats were the order of the day in Macomb and Holly Springs. In Summit, near southwest Macomb, Mississippi, the home of a Negro woman was bombed. She lives by herself about 25 feet from the highway. She is not affiliated with the civil rights movement in any way, although the sheriff said that the only damage was that the house was shaken a little bit. A reverend attached to the COFO project said that a 10 by 18 inch hole was blasted through the metal awning of her home. No one, fortunately, was injured. In Holly Springs on Christmas Day, the Antioch Baptist Church's mailbox was totally destroyed by a bomb. Later that same afternoon, a bomb was exploded about 4 miles down the road from the church, but no damage was reported. That afternoon in Holly Springs at the Antioch Church site, where workers are repairing some previous bomb damage, a worker was threatened by a white man who told him, quote, "You'll be sorry when that church is finished being repaired," close of quotes. The man was recognized by some of the 20 people on hand at the time. Local authorities and the FBI were notified. Hill, the worker threatened, also is housing 6 students from Oberlin College who are in Holly Springs to help rebuild the church.
Desegregation attempts continued during the holiday season. In Laurel, Mississippi, 20 persons were arrested for trying to eat in at the Traveler's Inn coffee shop. And later that Christmas Eve night, 8 demonstrators carrying candles and wearing black armbands and singing freedom songs and Christmas carols were stopped from serenading the jailed persons by the high sheriff. He drove up and scattered the group by almost running them down in his car. After this incident, 4 observers, including Lou House, radio newsman from WAAF Radio in Chicago, were set upon by Jones County deputy sheriffs, and House's tape recorder was smashed, and then they were told to beat it or the Klan would get them. The tape recorder was recovered by a sergeant from the Laurel Police Department and returned to House the next day. The FBI called that night and was given the information about the incident. On Christmas Day, the 2 COFO communications workers and House left Laurel, but were again stopped in Covington County and detained an hour or so by Sheriff Bill Canfield. And in their detention, he wanted to discuss several things and issues about the rights movement here in Mississippi.
Sheriff Canfield marched in 2 Negro prisoners, a father and a son by the name of Sullivan, and asked them to explain how well Negroes were being treated in Covington County. Then he asked the 3 of us to talk with him alone so he would feel free to explain how good separate but equal facilities really are. Ironically, the younger Sullivan explained that he was in jail on a phony charge. Canfield kept calling his friends the Sullivans niggers. When we asked him whether he would encourage Negroes to vote, he said, "No, that isn't necessary. We take care of them all right down here. They don't need to vote." He said that Nikita Khrushchev, or whoever else was in charge now, was actually directing our government in Washington, D.C. He attacked President Johnson as a communist dupe and accused Martin Luther King and Vice President Humphrey as power-hungry politicians who wanted to take over the government. He said that his wish is that if civil rights workers went home, then there would be no problems. They're making the Negroes, he said, think and causing them trouble. They were happy before.
After this discussion, the group was issued a $12 fine for having improper functioning equipment on their car.
You are listening to the 50th anniversary of the Mississippi Freedom Summer 1964, with newly discovered and restored broadcasts, exclusively found here in the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Pacifica Radio presents Mississippi Delta, Part 1.
Mayor Sampson, could you give us some ideas to just what the relationship between the races has been, the Delta area here and in the Greenwood area particularly?
I'll be glad to. The race relations in Greenwood, particularly with Floyd County, I can tell you about. Of course, I know something about them throughout the Delta. I've lived in Greenwood since 1917, and we have never had anything but good relations. We have lived happily for almost 100 years now, and I think the colored peoples in Greenwood or in any town in the Mississippi Delta or Mississippi would tell you that they're very happy with the situation. They've always been treated fairly by the whites, and they want to continue to live the way they want to. They don't want any interference out of Washington.
Oh, the time won't get no better here. I'm going down the road. I'm going away.
In 1930, I hear a lot of people talk about the panic. 1930 was a terrible time. But I'm 45 years old, and just as long as I've been where I can remember, it was a panic on with me. Because I don't remember, I believe, 3 weeks at a time that I just had enough food. And I ain't never had just what I would want to eat. Never had it. We ain't never had it. We work like convicts all day long. I have chopped cotton all day and come home and be too tired to cook. But I still would have to just cook what I did have. And then we working all of this time, we wouldn't have change in clothes. But the same white people said, well, it ain't nothing in the cotton, but they riding in fine cars and everything. And we still going through that same pressure, just nothing. And something definitely got to be done.
Well, And the other way is kind of like this, they kind of handicap all the way around on a plantation. And this is the reason. You take one of them much, you ain't got anything to do. You can borrow just $50 from the man, see? And the work he give you during the spring, you got to pay on that and try to live out of it too. You broke all year round, see? And that'll cost. You ain't getting much for your labor, in no way. You got other bills to pay, got the man to pay, you got dry goods store man to pay, insurance, light bill, bear and club. Well, you was always broke. That other way, you just broke year round. It's about the same position.
There's one thing about you always wrong and they always right. He can come right out there on the highway and bump your car. You got to pay him, say. And you go get the police, you just want to go on and just pay your money because the police gonna read to them. So you always wrong. I'm 44 years old, and they ain't never treated me right.
Mississippi has the lowest per capita income of any state in the Union. But adding to the plight of the Delta Negro is the meagerness of his share of that less than abundant economy. Income distribution in the state as a whole is extremely uneven. The lowest third of consumer units receive about 5% of the income, while the top third have about 70%. That lower third, however considered, is invariably black. But in more concrete terms, while the median income of the Delta white is between $3,000 and $4,000, the median income of the Delta Negro is about $900 a year. Further exacerbating this situation is the state's tax policy. While heavy and substantial tax write-offs and exemptions are given new industry, the state raises in excess of 50% of its revenues from general sales and use taxes. In 1960, the state of Mississippi even provided for the gradual reduction of the maximum rate on existing corporate and individual incomes. Economically, the situation of the Delta Negro is getting rapidly worse.
Any part of the tractor driver, just $5 a day.
And hoe hands, hoeing cotton, they get less.
$2.50 a day.
Well, I drive a tractor and do mechanic work and don't get but $7 a day.
$7 a day. And how many hours a day do you work?
Oh, that's around the globe from morning to night. You go when you can't see. Uh-huh. When you come in, you can't see.
How regular is your work? Do you work all the year round, or are there periods of the year when you can't get work?
When it's weather set in, you can't do anything. That's hold up then to spring. You start back to work.
I got about 3 months of real work in farm steady come back.
What do you do the rest of the year?
First one thing, kind of hustle for the way we do it on the place we live.
Well, the average farm labor around through Holmes County in this Delta area, it gets just about half of the year's work. The biggest work, right stood in the spring of the year when they're breaking up and planting. They get over all the farmland broke up and planted, then they get some break. They got nothing to do. And then after that, they start to cultivating it and hoeing it, and it go right studded in right through the cultivating and hoeing season. It's over with, and if it's dry, it don't last long. And then they got nothing to do again. And then the harvesting time, they start to working hard again. And most of these shell Delta planters in this Delta era, they use mechanical machines to harvest their whole crop with. And they don't use much hand labor. Do it mostly by machinery, and just a few men's does it. Mm-hmm. And the men that do this work, well, the most of them gets just about 6 months work out of 12 months, out of a year. They get about, it'll average about 6 months work. And there are 6 months they don't have nothing to do. And they'd be pretty hard up because they don't have nothing to do but hunt and frolic around and pick up little jobs. And it ain't too many of them they can do.
Well, I tell you one thing about it. Man can't live with no $5 a day. He that's handicapped. He just can't hardly make it at that. I make $7 a day with all that work I done. Well, you can't hardly make it out there. Mm-hmm. And you got to pay light bill, house rent. You ain't got nothing.
How many have in the family?
Five kids, me and my wife.
I guess that's what they get today, and during the summer months, winter months, I'm rabbit hunting with them. So that's about it. We all work the same in one work, more or less the others work too. That's...
Well, I just get $5 all the way around. I don't get no six. And from one end to the other, if we left, they have any work to do that long, but they don't have no work to do that long.
What do you get paid for picking cotton?
Well, last year, before I was fired off of this plantation, we was getting $2 a hundred if we was in his field. But if we was picking in our own field, we got $1 per hundred because we didn't get any rebate or nothing like that. And we had to pick for $1 a hundred.
And how long does it take you to pick 100 pounds of cotton?
Well, the cotton wasn't too good last year, and it didn't pick too good. I never did pick. At the time I was getting $1 a hundred, I never did pick 200. And we had, the week I was fired, we had picked 1,144 pounds.
See, when you're on this plantation, if you're making a crop, they give you a little funny. Well, I have to pay my light bill out of it, my doctor bill out of it, and then buy the food I get. And then if you chop any cotton, you get $3 a day.
The economic lot of the Delta Negro has always been hard and barren. But until recently, he had always been guaranteed a subsistence minimum, for his labor had always been an absolutely necessary aspect of the cotton process. But now that process is being transformed by the technological and economic revolution we call automation. And in the new order, the sharecropper and field hand increasingly find that they have no place.
And they get all the machinery they can get. And they hire just less labor as they can. Then when they hire somebody to hoe or pick cotton, it's because they have rainy weather and they big machines can't get around over the phone. Then they run around and look up a little labor. But when it's dry, the labor really suffers. It just be hundreds of peoples, colored peoples, in all of these little towns, surfing, half-eaten, going barefooted, because they can't get no work to do. That's all over Mississippi, the Delta part.
Well, as much as 5 years ago and years now. See, when they plant the cotton and use pre-mud, well, that stops you from chopping. You don't have to chop. It'd be about 6 weeks then before you chop. Well, after that, they got some lay-by now. After cotton get up a certain distance, they put that lay-by on it. Well, that stops them from plowing and chopping both. It's running this thing out there that the colored people won't have nothing to do on these farms. They're going to use about 7, 8 tractor drives. They're cutting them down to 3 and 4. Because they're getting tractors big enough to can the equipment to cut our labor.
You are listening to the 50th anniversary of the Mississippi Freedom Summer 1964 with newly discovered and restored broadcasts exclusively found here in the Pacifica Radio Archives. To find out more about this program or other programs in our From the Vault collection, go to fromthevaultradio.org or call us here at the Archives at 1-800-735-0230. And now, back to our program. The clearest picture of the dynamics of the present cotton economy was that drawn by Howell Peebles, president of the Greenwood Bank of Commerce and a principal member of the Greenwood White Citizens Council. The following is not an actuality recording, but a recreated interview written from notes and produced in the studios of WBAI. Mr. Peebles was quite generous with his time and information, but following a pattern that became uniform for almost all the whites we talked to, he refused to permit the recording of our discussion.
You see, it used to be that the cotton economy here in the Delta depended on the Negro field labor. There never have been very many whites here except managers and overseers. 30 years ago, tractors were about the only form of mechanization we had. And there weren't many of them. Now, the Greenwood area alone has a farm machinery industry worth about $500,000 annually. Mechanization, it's changed the whole cotton process from planting to picking. 20 years ago, A 1,600-acre plantation employed from, 40 to 50 Negro families. And now, what with planting limitations and mechanization, the same plantation will use only 10 or even less.
Has mechanization and automation of the cotton process then begun to phase out the old sharecropper system?
In a way, yes. Of course, it's still in use. But the number of sharecroppers has shrunk along with the general decline of field labor. They say we're trying to drive the Negro off the land. Like every other industry, we mechanize because we have to, because it's more efficient. If we didn't, we couldn't stay in business. Look now, a Negro picks 200 pounds of cotton in a day. A two-row picking machine picks 20 bales a day. That's 32,000 pounds. On top of that, the hand picking is more incompetent every year. They don't just pick cotton like a machine will do. They'll put rocks and clods and weeds and sticks and just anything in easy reach to make that sack weigh out as soon as possible. The result is dirty cotton, and there's no market for anything but the highest grade cotton these days. You see, the cotton market has really been cut into over the years. First of all, the synthetics have cut way in. Take tire cord, for instance. The rubber companies used to be one of the biggest markets for cotton because they made tire cord from it. Now they use synthetics. That whole market is gone. We can go down the list from now till supper. Synthetics have really hurt the cotton economy. Then there's the competition of foreign countries who are able to produce unlimited quantities of cotton at a low cost. A lot of this is produced on aid given these countries by the U.S. government. And this tends to push us out of the export market. Because while they can produce cotton on unlimited acreage, and therefore cut their cost per unit down, we have to operate under the acreage limitation of the Farm Subsidy Program.
But hasn't the Farm Subsidy and Acreage Limitation Plan helped the small farmer to stay in business where otherwise he might have been driven out?
Maybe some, but not for the most part. Now, one thing you might say it has done is to increase the productivity per acre. That's the only way the planter can keep his head above water. But this is done by using new techniques and mechanization. Machinery costs money, and the smaller farmer just hasn't got that kind of money. A planter with 2,000 or 3,000 acres can make new machinery pay for itself pretty quickly and at a small percentage of his gross. For a man with, say, 200 acres, it's a different story. If he rents the machinery, as most of them do, then the bale of cotton he sells costs just that much more to produce, and he hasn't even got a machine to show for it. The Farm Subsidy Program has kept a few just barely this side of bankruptcy, kept inefficient farms from going under. But for the most, they just can't afford it. That's really not bad. The fact is that cotton is a crop that cannot be produced efficiently on small acreage. That's why the acreage limitation doesn't work. We can produce more per acre, but the profit margin is smaller than it used to be. Differences between the cost of raising the crop and the selling price. And the efficient raising of cotton requires an increasingly high level of capitalization. The trend has to be back to the large plantation. An acreage limitation needs to be raised or taken off altogether so that the planter can reduce the per unit cost of his crop. You see, a cultivator or a picking machine costs the same amount whether you use it on 100 or 1,000 acres. Otherwise, cotton is going to go on losing out to synthetics, and domestic cotton is going to go on losing out to foreign cotton, and the cotton economy here in the Delta is going to go from bad to worse.
Well, certainly it has caused a problem with the laboring force, with the colored people in particular, on account of the mechanization, where a plantation owner used to have anywhere, say if he had 40 or 50 families.
Mayor Sampson of Greenwood.
I'm sure with this mechanization, he has reduced that to about 10 families. It's just any mechanization in any plant sometime will certainly reduce their labor force. And that is one reason that many of our colored people have been leaving the Mississippi Delta, going into other parts of Mississippi, in particular other parts of the country. And the mechanization with the improvements in the flamethrowers, as we call them, for the grass control is being improved all the time, and it'd just be a few years where the whole crop will be mechanization, and that's advancement, and it's advancement in the economy and the farm
in the farm program, of course, it reduces the labor. But now,
is there any program in this area, any local program to offset the effects of this mechanization on the labor force?
Well, of course, the Greenwood has gone very well in the industrial program. We have about five nice industries that have been located here during the last 7 years, and which quite a few of our colored people are working in these industries. But of course, it's many of them that's on the farm are not trained. They need a training program.
The state has not concentrated its efforts in this field, although the statistics would indicate this is where the effort should be.
Harding Carter III, managing editor of the Greenville Delta Democrat Times.
Major vocational training for the kinds of new jobs which are coming in have been centered on schools which only whites can attend. Most of the vocational training open to Negroes, trains them as tractor drivers or as stonemasons, carpenters, this sort of thing, which is a limited field and becoming more limited insofar as agricultural work is concerned every year. The state is vitally concerned about the effect that this automation on the farm, which is the most immediate and severe automation in the United States, the effect this has had on the white, well, on the state community. But the new factories that have come in, the new industries, by and large, rigorously apply, if not in name, in fact, a quota system on hiring so that Negroes, by and large, don't have a job. Secondarily, of course, and this is as true even for those who want to do more, they find that the Negro, who has done nothing but hoe cotton for the last 100 years or 200 years, simply does not have the training to do anything along the line of what is needed in a metal plant or anything else. Now, there are some signs that the state is going to attempt to take some steps to rectify this, but almost all the programs that I've heard discussed center around schools, around facilities which are basically white.
So that you think also perhaps the new industry coming into the state has pretty much taken up the slack in white unemployment created by mechanization on the farm, but it hasn't done this for the Negro?
Oh, I'd say this has definitely been true. I don't think it's taken up the entire slack for the whites. The depressed white in Mississippi is as bad off, except for his color and what that means, but economically is a depressed Negro. But at least...
How extensive is the depressed white in Mississippi?
Frankly, I don't know. I mean, I just couldn't answer that. But he will be the first hired whenever there's any opening for his kind of labor.
Basically, two choices lie open to the Delta Negro in this untenable situation. The first is the old, the traditional one, which runs like an organizing theme through the songs and stories of Negro folklore.
Yes, I'm leaving in the morning, but I don't know where to go. I'm leaving in the morning, mama, but I don't know where to go.
I'm gone up north,
that is high.
Leaving the South is still the first choice of many. The state of Mississippi alone loses over 30,000 of its Negro population each year. But that choice, unpalatable to many who consider Mississippi their home as much as Ross Barnett's, is also often more apparent than real. Those who leave the Delta and migrate to the great cold northern cities find themselves in an even larger pool of the unemployed, find themselves competing for jobs with an even greater disadvantage in terms of skills and education. And in the past year and a half, a portion of the northward flood has begun to trickle back to the Delta. It is, after all, better to be jobless at home, around friends and family, than in the concrete canyons of Chicago and New York. The second choice, the one which the Delta Negro is more and more coming to see as the only real one, will be the subject of the second part of this documentary, The Movement.
My boy, my baby, he's 8 years old. Well, he used to say, well, Mom, it's for us to go to school and we'll learn more, and then say we can have more. Well, the movement, that brought about food, you know. Clothes, the truck would come out there with a lot of food on it, you know. And lots of clothes, and they would put it all out there, you know. And that was just a big, they thought that was wonderful. All of that food. Ooh, man, this room would hold the food and clothes, you know. So they would get out there and jump around, and he says, Mama, he said, if freedom means plenty of food and clothes, he said, we just need freedom.
The Citizens' Council's avowed nonviolence and its assault on the movement and its supporters is not always the order of the day in the Mississippi Delta. The following three cases offer an indication of what the local Negro who takes an active part is or may be up against. Dalton Turnbow is a Negro farmer in Holmes County on the eastern edge of the Delta. Mr. Turnbow is one of the staunchest of the local cadres the Delta movement has developed. His case instigated last spring the interposition of the Justice Department between him and Holmes County law enforcement officers.
So about 3 o'clock, my wife waked me up screaming, hollering, said the house was bombed. Right at that time, I waked up and rubbed my eyes and opened them, and the room was full of smoke. So I kicked the window out, raised the window, and kicked the scream out to let some of the smoke out so I could find my gun. So I grabbed my gun, a 22 automatic Remington rifle, and I pushed the safety down, and I started out. As I was going out, I noticed the living room was filled with flames and smoke. I went out through the kitchen. I noticed the back bedroom was filled with flames and smoke. So I met my wife and daughter coming back in the house. They ran out before I did. I met them coming back right at the steps, back steps. So I run out in the yard where I could get a clear view looking upside of the east side of the house. I saw two white men, one standing in the corner of the house and the other standing out in the opening. He had a pistol in his hand. He fired at me, so then I start shooting. He shot two more times, then he broke and run to the front of the house that was headed north. And right at that time, while me and this man are shooting, had the pistol, where shooting started on the front of the house. Then I run back to the west side of the house in the backyard and start the shooting towards the front again. So I finish emptying my rifle right there at that point. So the shooting all ceased it in about 3 minutes, and the shooting was all over. Then myself, wife, and daughter start the fighting fire. So we had to fight fire hard, pump water and tote it, and fight it for about an hour before we could get all the fire under control. And then we sit on the back porch then till broad day, till the sun rise, myself, wife, and daughter. After that, we went over to Ozell Mitchell and asked one of the singing boys would he call the FBI. He said he would, and he made the call and told me he got them. They were coming. So by that time, Mr. Bob Lespie, which is a is a constable of Chula, and Mr. Moe, which is the police of Chula. They came down first. They was the first white peoples to get to the scene. So Mr. Bob Lesper, he said to me, you keep in company with the wrong kind of peoples. Here's a reason for all of this. And you keep in company with the wrong kind of peoples, these outside agitators. And I told him the outside agitators was teaching me how to reddish and how to vote. And I thought that was all right. I didn't think that were the wrong kind of people. So then Mr. Smith said it could have been me. Say, I could have done it myself. I asked Mr. Smith, do you think I'd set my own house afire and ain't got no insurance on the house, myself, my wife, the car, the pickup and the tractor, and all of that would have burnt up if the house had a burnt with no insurance on anything? Told him, no, sir, I didn't do it. You got me wrong. Those two white men did it. So he left and went back to town, and FBI's come and they questioned me, and we answered lots of questions for the FBI's, and they wrote up. So late that evening, just about dusk dark, Mr. Smith come back, Mr. Andrew P. Smith, the sheriff, and he said to me, Turnbow, come here. I walked out there where he was. He had Mr. Bob Lesby with him and one of his same deputies. It was three of them. So I walked out to his car, and the sheriff said, Turnbow, I got a writ for you. Get him up. So I put my hands up, and the deputy behind me, he pat me down. So I said, what is the writ for? He says, for arsonist, get in the car. So I got on in the car. He took me and put me in jail. Said I burnt my own house. So I stayed in jail 2 days, just about 2 days. And the Justice Department, they got me out.
Fannie Lou Hamer of Sunflower County, home of Senator Eastland, is another Delta Negro. She, too, can bear witness to the fact that nonviolence is not a universally respected doctrine in white Mississippi.
I was put in a cell with Evesta Simpson, and after they put us in a cell, they put some in a cell, and they got all of them in there but two. And I couldn't see them beating them, but I could hear them screaming. And after a while, they brought one of the girls, was 15 years old, June Johnson, from Greenwood. They brought her and put her in the cell along with Rosemary Freeman. And then they taken Annie L. Pund out. And I could hear her screaming, and I could hear them calling her names, and I could just hear the sound, you know, the sounds of licks. So the state highway patrolman, he asked me questions and asked me where was I from, and I told him Ruval, and he said he was gonna check. So I figured then that if he did call Ruval, they know I work with the voter registration work. Well, my reputation would be kind of bad. But wasn't nobody trying to demonstrate. We wasn't trying to do anything. The rest of them was trying to get food, but I wasn't even trying to do that because...
This wasn't a sit-in demonstration in Winona?
It wasn't. We were just... They was trying to get food. We were trying to get home, and they wanted to eat, and that was all. So he did, after a while, he came back into my cell, and he start asking me, said, why did you get with these other people to start trying to demonstrate out here? So, well, we gonna make you wish you was dead. And when they led me to a cell, it was this state highway patrolman and this other tall man about 6 feet that had on dark blue pants and a lighter blue shirt, and it was one then had on dark pants and a white shirt. And they led me in the cell where it was two Negro prisoners. And they told these Negroes, if they didn't beat me, well, they know what they would get. So this highway patrolman gave the first Negro, was young, the blackjack. And the Negro asked him, said,
is this what I'm going to use? And he told him he was right. That's what he was going to use. And he told me to get down on the cot, you know, on the bunk bed. And I got down on my face and laid on my face. And it was awful. It was awful. He beat, and I was screaming. And the young white man with the crew haircut and the black pants and the white shirt on, he got up. He was kind of squatting over in front of me because I could see him because I was laying on my face. He got up and just started just beating away in my head, you know, to make me stop. I went to muffle out the scream so I wouldn't scream so loud because it was miserable. It was horrible. That really hurt. I caught the tick, you know, and just buried my face down in it to keep from making sounds, you know, to keep them maybe probably would stop. So after the first Negro had beat me till he looked like was tired, he gave the blackjack to the other one. And I asked him, I said, how can you do your own race like this? And he told me I'd better move my hand. So my feet, you know, he done beat me, so I had to, you know, move my feet because it was hurting. And I was trying to keep the licks off of my left side because I had polio when I was a child. And I know too much beating on that, I might probably wouldn't walk again. So the first one beat me. The highway patrolman told him to set on my feet so the second one could beat. So the first one set on my feet, and the second one that had to beat, he began beating. And he beat me in my dress. During the time they beating, my dress come up, and I tried to smooth it down, and this man that had on the blue pants and the lighter blue shirt raised my dress up. It was a horrible experience.
For the local Negro who supports the movement without becoming one of its workers, who responds to the call to register to vote, vengeance is ordinarily less severe, but it is often swift, sure, and unmistakable for all that.
So I went down and registered the 24th of April, and after I went down and registered, I was living out here on Mr. Fleming's. He's a little low, too. And he found out that I had registered. I imagine they called him from down there, you know, to Indianola. So he wouldn't just tell me that I had been down, but he told me that he wanted me to move off the place. Well, after I registered, they told me here that if I go down and have to be moved, you see, they would see after me. So I went up there that Friday. He was up there in town at the drugstore. And I told him, I said, well, Mr. T, I come to see you. He said, what is it? I said, you told me to move. I said, I come to let you know I'm ready to move. See, they had got me a house. And when I told him that, he told me, said, no, ain't a son bitch in the world going out there and move nothing out of that house. Then he turned around, he told me, said, you go back down there until I see father. I said, yes. I went on back down there and stayed down there. And that Monday, he sent the light man down there. I'm sitting up in the house and cut the lights off. And I had plenty of market in the refrigerator. So I took my market and put this some more people's house in the refrigerator and left there and come on back. He sent for me. I went on back down there. He said, Sally, I said, sir. He said, you done went fool around and let them got you in that mess. He said, but I'm telling you one thing. I want my damn house. I said, yes, sir. I want you to move. I said, yes, sir. So I said, can I get somebody to come in? He said, all I want a son bitch in the world to move nothing out of that house. I said, well, they can stay there. And I walked on off. And they're down there yet.
All of your belongings?
Clothes and everything. Right there. Right down the road there. Right there now. So I ain't been back down there.
What plantation is that?
Now, T. Fleming's all I can tell you. That's, they got it rented now. I don't know whose plantation it is, but it's right down there on the other side of that old shed.
Number eight,
right down the road there. And, course, he didn't tell me this, but one of his hands on the place, I went down there one Sunday evening. Now, he hadn't told me nothing about what he gonna do to me. And I went down there that Sunday evening, and I went around to another friend of mine's house and spent the night. And that boy come there for daylight that morning and told me, he said, don't let Mr. Fleming see you. See, because he said, anywhere he see you, he gonna stomp you under the ground.
Do you mind my asking you how old you are?
No, sir, and I don't mind telling you. I am 59 years old. The 30th of September, if I live to see it, I will be 60.
The effect of the movement on Mississippi's politics has already been marked and is almost surely to be profound. The various aspects of the movement and the challenges it poses to the institution of segregation furnished about 90% of the rhetoric during the Democratic primary elections this summer, victory in which is tantamount to election proper, the official contest between Republican and Democratic candidates being, in spite of recent Republican gains, still largely a formality. It was a strange campaign in which all the candidates outdid one another in defending segregation, attacking the Kennedy administration, and accusing one another of being too moderate.
You think the Negro vote is going to make a large difference in the political atmosphere and the political dialogue of the South?
This is David Powell, director of the AFL-CIO's Council on Political Education, Area 5.
Yes, I do, because the Negro vote and the Negro problem is basically an economic problem. And the Negro vote will support, all things being equal, will support the more liberal of the candidates.
And so that this is more than just a racial vote. It's essentially an economic.
Oh, yes. Of course, the racial aspect is a solidifying force, where the race issue is not raised in a political campaign. The Negro vote is not percentage-wise and percent to the number registered is large, nor is it quite as cohesive. But by and large, the Negro vote is an economic vote.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. For a copy of this program or programs in this series, visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us toll-free in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres with support from the Pacifica Radio Archives staff. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, funded in part from Pacifica Station listeners like you. Current preservation projects are funded in part by grants from the Grammy Foundation and the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration.